You can
I'm recording now, so ready.
Excellent.
Thanks.
Okay, why don't we go ahead and get started? So, I'll first of all introduce our pulmonary fellow who is going to take the first case for us. Thanks everybody for joining us this morning for our Pulmonary Pathology Journal Club. Late January 2024, discussing articles that were published in December 2023. So, our fellow pulmonary pathology fellow down at Mayo Clinic in Arizona is Dr. Samantha Moore. Sam has been with us for the last 6 or 7 months, and she's going to be presenting the first case. So, Sam, why don't you take it away?
All right, thanks, Dr. Larson. I'll go ahead and share my screen. Can everybody see the article? All
Yes.
right. So I picked this article by the Brigham group on their question they tackled was how do we distinguish thymic epithelial neoplasms from their morphologic mimics? And polyclonal PAX8 is often used in this scenario. We use the polyclonal because the monoclonal just isn't sensitive enough, but the polyclonal PAX8 lacks specificity. And so we were kind of looking for something that might shed light and be a better marker for us. And so this group investigated PAX1 as a candidate to looking for higher sensitivity and specificity for thymic epithelium. So what they did, move my little screen thing out of the way. Okay, what they did was I think their N was really good. They got 100 thymic epithelial neoplasms and 119 morphologic mimics. And the study was just to distinguish the thymic epithelial neoplasms from the mimics. They used what's called an H score, which I am somewhat familiar with in theory because I've used something like it in research before, but hadn't heard it called an H score. It's using a combination of the percentage staining and the intensity staining, and you kind of combine this into a semi-quantitative number, and their scale ranged from 0 to 300, and then you can make arbitrary, cutoffs wherever you like, and I think that's sort of part of the point to see where the cutoff should be for declaring something positive. Now, as far as performance, there was the PAX1 performed great in thymomas, especially the type A thymomas, just knocked it out of the park. A little bit, it's a little bit less great in type down to through the Bs. Thymic carcinomas still did pretty well. Thymic neuroendocrine tumors, a little bit less well than that. So thymomas, thymic carcinomas, thymic neuroendocrine tumors seem to be our main three categories of tumors that we stained, and then of course all the morphologic mimics. This is their main data table here. And a bunch of their data are also presented in the results paragraphs over here, which I found a little bit clunky to interpret since they were trapped in paragraphs and not put in a table. So I took the liberty of taking what they wrote and putting it into a data table just so it's easier to see. So if you look at thymomas versus morphologic mimics, the sensitivity for PAX1 was 100% with a specificity of 75. Now, if you calibrate that for 100% specificity, if you hold that specificity at 100%, then your sensitivity drops to 92. And I think they did that by varying the threshold at which positivity was said to be true. Now, with thymic carcinomas versus extrathymic squames, you get a little bit lower sensitivity specificity, 82 and 66% respectively. And if you hold that specificity at 100%, the sensitivity drops to 47%. Now, for the neuroendocrine tumors, 89 and 60% respectively for sensitivity specificity. And then if you hold the specificity at 100%, sensitivity drops to 56%. So those were the general data and results they got. A huge caveat that they threw into the picture was the pitfall that there was, I'll say their words, frequent geographic reduction in staining consistent with compromised antigenicity from variable formalin fixation. So if there's any sort of issue with fixation at the lab and trying to get these numbers to agree from lab to lab where they might have different staining protocols and so forth, that might be an issue. Stain intensity variability was the main complaint with PAX1. So they said it all in all, the marker is unlikely to supplant the role of PAX8 in distinguishing thymic epithelial neoplasms from their morphologic mimics, but it could be used as an adjunct. So I'd love to hear from folks. How often do you find yourself using PAX8? How often do you might you find yourself using PAX1 with these data that were presented here? And I will. They did a one little caveat too. They did a head-to-head of PAX1 versus PAX8 for a couple of different tumors. Here's some thymic carcinomas, and here are in figures 5 and 6 some thymic carcinoids. But again, the results were less than 100% clear cut. I thought we were looking for something that was going to solve all our problems. I don't think PAX1 is it, but I think these guys did an amazing job at a very thorough analysis. So I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Interesting. We can't use our PAX8 because we have a monoclonal and not the polyclonal. And I think I tried it a couple of times and it never worked in thymomas or thymic carcinomas. But it would be interesting to see if they used, or they probably didn't, but how it would compare to the CD5 and CD117 in comparison to the lung squamous cell carcinomas. That
sure
might be
would.
A comparison.
Yeah, that would be great. And again, the antibody they used, I don't know whether I mentioned, for PAX1 was actually monoclonal. It wasn't polyclonal, but we were going for a higher specificity, so that kind of makes sense. But that whole issue of exactly which clone we're using could be relevant.
Now, for clinical practice, I was wondering when you said to adjust to a specificity of 100%, what's the percentage of cells that should be positive for this kind of specificity? I mean, it's difficult to put an H score into clinical practice.
It is. And one group determines what their H score is and what their idea of an H score is, at least the way I interpret what they're doing. And then another group might interpret that differently. The data that you're seeing here were interpreted by two of the three authors, and they sort of had a consensus. But I mean, you get more people in the mix, and I'm not sure. They said an H score positive threshold of 75 on a scale of 300. And again, taking something so semi-quant and making it, making specific numbers always makes me raise an eyebrow just because of my science background. But yeah, so I'm not, I think there might be some variability there, but that's just my own bias.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Sam. I don't know that I use markers very often in my clinical practice to decide if something is thymic in origin. I don't know what other folks' practice is. Maybe PAX8 once in a while, but most of the time the clinical presentation, the imaging findings are, I find to be more helpful than marker expression for making a case that something arose in the thymus. It's obviously in the anterior mediastinum and kind of looks like a thymic epithelial neoplasm, then it probably is. And if it isn't presenting in that fashion, it probably isn't. But maybe that's just my own experience. I don't know about others. I don't know that I'm convinced that I'm ready to start bringing up PAX1 in our lab, though. I don't know that it would be all that helpful at this time.
I don't think it's going to be on our list.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff.
But it was a really useful paper, and thanks for summarizing it. I really appreciate it.
Any other comments on case one? Or, sorry, paper number one, I should say. Still waking up this morning. If not, we'll move on to paper two. Thanks, Dr. Moore, for presenting that. The second paper this morning is by first author Wan Jing. I'm probably mispronouncing his name. But this is senior authored by Sanjay Mukhopadhyay at Cleveland Clinic. And this is a lovely little study, basically a large case series of patients with airway injury caused by aspiration of iron sulfate pills. So there have been case reports of iron sulfate pill aspiration in the literature, isolated case reports and very small case series. Juan and Sanjay somehow put together 11 cases, which I think is quite remarkable. I don't know where they found all of them, but they basically did a retrospective review of their own pathology archives, I think solely at Cleveland Clinic, over the course of about 10 years, I think 2013 to 2023, and found all of the cases of iron pill aspiration that they could find. And then they retrospectively reviewed the histology and any cytology material if it was available, and then looked at the clinical history and the imaging. They ended up with 18 endobronchial biopsies from 11 different patients. Seven of them were women, four were men. The average age was 70, but the range was quite wide, 44 to 82. And interestingly, 8 out of 11 folks also had corresponding cytology that was available to look at, which is great. When they looked at medication history, all people with available history were taking iron sulfate pills. Of 11 people, only 2 of those 11 reported a history of possible aspiration. And an additional 4 had risk factors for aspiration. So that's 6 out of 11. 5 out of the 11 had no history of aspiration and no risk factors for aspiration. And I think that is not entirely surprising. We know how often aspiration goes unnoticed, and how it can occur in the absence of even risk factors. Interestingly, out of those 11 patients, only 1 patient was clinically suspected to be aspirating prior to the biopsy. Histologically, the features were as you might expect. I think a picture is worth 1,000 words. I'm going to try to just share my screen because I think in the paper the real value here is the images themselves. So I'm going to see if I can successfully share my screen. Please let me know if you see it.
Yes.
You guys see my screen? Okay. Yes. Just wanted to share the figures with everybody because, you know, we're a visual specialty and we like seeing pictures better than listening to me talk or looking at words. So this first figure that was illustrated, they showed an example of iron pill aspiration on imaging. This person was choking after eating food and had a history of anoxic brain injury. And you can see the chest radiograph and chest x-rays with these opacities and opacification in the right lung. And on bronchoscopy, there was an obstructive lesion in one of the bronchi with mucoid impaction, which was seen in some cases. In other cases, the endobronchial findings were quite dramatic, and this is, they show in figure 2 from, I believe, four different patients, all of whom had this brown discoloration of the bronchial mucosa, which is, I think, quite striking in some of these cases, in addition to mucosa ulceration in some of the cases. So iron pills are caustic. They certainly have effects when they're retained down in the GI tract and can cause mucosal injury. Not surprisingly, in the bronchus, they can do the same thing. So variable degrees of mucosal ulceration and brown discoloration are seen by the clinician. And then here's the histology. So transbronchial biopsies here with these beautiful these areas of incrustation of connective tissue fibers with this brown mineralized pigment consistent with iron. It looks like iron would look anywhere in the body, but in the airway there's what it looks like. And of course you can do tissue iron stains and highlight that iron as shown here in the lower panel. I think there's a couple more, at least one more figure here if I scroll down. Yeah, here's another one showing the extent of tissue reaction that can occur with iron pill aspiration in an endobronchial biopsy. So mucosal ulceration is often seen histologically as well with granulation tissue. And other case, you can have squamous metaplasia, which to me is also not entirely surprising. And there can be tissue necrosis as shown here in panel C. And in all of these cases, the iron pigment that's present is in these big chunky crystalline particles, but smaller particles of iron pigment can also be seen. So, which might raise other things in the differential diagnosis, like iron from welding perhaps, or iron from prior bleeding, but these big chunky crystalline particles would not be expected in something like that, in prior bleeding or welding fume exposure. So that really helps you clinch the diagnosis in an appropriate clinical setting. They show the same thing in a cytology specimen here in figure 5. So you can see reactive bronchial mucosal cells in these various smears, and then these big shards of crystallized iron sulfate from the aspirated pill fragments that have degenerated down in the airways. So the conclusions they made, a couple of the big clues are the discolored mucosa on bronchoscopy, and then the big crystalline fragments down in either biopsy or cytology specimens. I think none of this is really that surprising. I've never actually seen a case myself. I thought this was a rather lovely study. I don't know if others have encountered any cases of iron pill aspiration, but certainly something to keep your eyes open for, and to think about if you see funny crystalline material and biopsy fragments. And burn these images into your brain. It might come in handy later. So anybody have any comments on this paper?
Brandon, thanks for sharing that. 11 in 10 years, and I don't recall seeing one ever. So like, what's going on in Cleveland? Do you think it's it's the alcohol? I mean, I don't know.
Maybe.
Are we missing this?
I wondered the same thing. I'd never seen this before either, and it's so striking in the photos. I definitely would have noticed this. I mean, those are gorgeous cases. It's the browns.
Well, that's what I wondered. I thought maybe it was. The Cavaliers, I don't know, Guardians, all of them.
Yeah, I'll have to ask Sanjay when I see him next. How in the world they dug up so many cases? I don't know if I'd find any. I don't know if I'd even find them. If I tried to find them, how would I search for them? But yeah, lovely pictures in that. All right. Well, and that was pretty straightforward. Unless anybody else has any other comments, I'll move on. But thought that would be a fun one to start with before I get into ones that I don't think are quite as fun, but ones that I thought were important to share with the group today. So the third paper today is actually a radiology paper. The Daniel Costin Marinescu is the primary author. Christopher Ryerson is the senior author. This is published in Chest. This is integration and application of radiologic patterns from clinical practice guidelines on IPF and fibrotic HP. So as you all know, clinical practice guidelines are out there for both IPF and fibrotic HP now, and providing a common language and defined criteria for not just these disorders, but obviously also degrees of certainty for each of these diagnoses. And we have those as pathologists, but the radiologists have those criteria as well, and degrees of certainty for their diagnoses. And in 2023, now 2024, you know, there's certainly this strong trend away from biopsy and to make diagnoses purely on clinical and radiologic grounds. And it remains unclear to what degree these consensus guidelines for both IPF and chronic HP can be used to reliably distinguish between these two disorders and where some of the pitfalls are. And so to kind of get at this, this group of authors, all from Canada, which includes our friends Andy Churg and Joanne Wright up in Vancouver, they used their Canadian Registry for Pulmonary Fibrosis and basically reviewed findings, clinical radiologic diagnoses in almost 1,600 patients, so 1,593. So what they did is over the course of, I think it was about a year and a half, I forget the exact dates, but it was basically 2021 through, I don't know, spring 2022 or something like that, maybe 15, 16 months. They looked at all patients who had a CT scan that was performed no more than 3 months prior to their initial evaluation for ILD and no more than 1 year after their ILD. So somewhere in the course of a proximal workup for ILD. And then they reviewed the clinical findings as well. And so what the way that they did this, it was kind of interesting. They identified these 1600 some odd patients, and then the radiologist, they had 18 radiologists and 14 clinicians. The radiologists were first tasked with identifying the radiographic features in a blinded fashion, blinded to clinical information. So they identified ground glass opacities and consolidation, reticulation, and distribution among in throughout the lungs, et cetera, and whether it was asymmetric or not asymmetric from side to side, and all those types of parameters. And then they assigned two patterns. They assigned a guideline pattern based on the UIP-IPF guidelines and the fibrotic HP guidelines. And then they also assigned their own gestalt pattern, if you will, their radiologist assigned pattern, ignoring the guidelines, but just calling it what they thought it was. And then also came up with a percent confidence level on radiology alone. So this was all done without clinical input, just the radiologists themselves that reviewed these cases. And then after the radiologic findings were tabulated and the guideline defined pattern was assigned and the radiologist gestalt pattern was assigned, then they brought the clinicians in and had a multidisciplinary discussion, or at least a multidisciplinary discussion that involved clinicians and radiologists. And from what I can tell in the paper, there was no pathology input into this MDD discussion. But what at the time of MDD, then with that clinical input, they came up with the most likely clinical diagnosis and the percent confidence in that diagnosis. And in addition to other potential diagnoses with less confidence, which sounds like a complicated way of looking at things. But then once they had done that, then they analyzed the patterns and percent confidence and to see if anything was useful. It's sort of the way what I took away from it. So the patterns they assigned, the guideline patterns, they basically combined the UIP-IPF guidelines and the fibrotic HP guidelines together in a scheme that I can show here. It's sort of be easier than me just describing it. I'll just share my screen here. So you can see these colored boxes here. So this grid of UIP radiologic patterns, typical, probable, indeterminate, and alternative diagnoses, crossed with fibrotic HP patterns, typical, compatible, or indeterminate fibrotic HP radiologic patterns, and considered these portions of the grid mutually exclusive. So if it was typical UIP of IPF, that was felt to be indeterminate for fibrotic HP based on the current guidelines. So they would call that a typical UIP category. And you can see here, they've got six total categories after combining the grids together: typical UIP, probable UIP, indeterminate for both UIP IPF and indeterminate for fibrotic HP pattern, compatible with fibrotic HP radiologic pattern with an alternative to UIP, typical fibrotic HP and alternative to everything, alternative UIP, indeterminate for fibrotic HP. So those are the six patterns that were assigned. So when they did that, after they put everything together, I won't go through all their clinical characteristics, but they saw those with typical or probable UIP radiologic patterns were more likely to be men, more likely to be smokers, cases that were felt to be indeterminate or more compatible or typical for fibrotic HP tended to be more women, non-smokers, kind of what you might expect. And then they looked at the individual patterns, both the guideline patterns and radiologist gestalt patterns, and how they broke out. And so, for example, a typical UIP guideline defined pattern, usually radiologists would assign a UIP pattern based on gestalt, whereas something that was indeterminate by guidelines was half the time indeterminate even just by gestalt, with, you know, a mixture of things all across the board, so nothing was all that great. And then the final multidisciplinary diagnosis by the integrated guideline defined radiologic pattern, you can, here's again the percentage of cases. So when radiology issued a guideline defined radiologic pattern as typical radiologic fibrotic HP pattern, about 2/3 of the time that was felt to be HP by MDD. When the guideline defined radiologic pattern was typical UIP, about 2/3 of the time the MDD felt that that was IPF with high confidence. But you can see how much uncertainty there is even here when guideline-defined radiologic patterns were applied and how that impacted multidisciplinary diagnosis. So I think what this shows is something that we would all expect anyway. When the radiologic findings were really classic for either UIP-IPF or classic for fibrotic HP, diagnostic confidence was high. And when the radiology was muddy, the multidisciplinary diagnosis and the degree of confidence in that were muddy as well. We know this through just our own practices. The authors do point out that the biggest thing that tended to upset the balance here was when the clinicians felt that the cases might have connective tissue disease related ILD or IPAF, which was sort of seen across all radiologic patterns. The one thing they did note was the presence of gas trapping or air trapping greater than 5% of lung parenchyma was a feature that helped them to separate compatible from typical fibrotic HP radiologic patterns from any other pattern. So we know that air trapping is something that our radiologists find to be useful, and this paper sort of adds more data to that idea and demonstrates that whether or not that simply represents circular thinking and confirming biases or confirming pattern that you know that has those criteria in it, and then they're recognized and then, you know, so defined versus something that is actually relevant biologically or medically, I guess, is something that hasn't been sorted out here. But be that as it may, I found this paper to be interesting simply because it shows the ongoing challenges in ILD diagnosis and pattern assignment among radiologists, which I think is quite similar to the type of challenges that we see. And a problem that I don't think is going to get solved by more clinical studies like this, and really illustrates to me the ongoing problem of the need for a good gold standard in ILD diagnosis. It's, the whole field is kind of a mess, and these kind of studies are important to be evaluating our current guidelines critically and whether or not they're useful or if they are problematic in real life practice. But we are overdue for some kind of breakthrough in this field to help refine our diagnoses. And I'm hopeful that pathology will have some kind of role to play still in this field as these biopsies disappear off of our desks. So with that, I'll stop talking. But certainly be interested in hearing anybody's comments about this. Jeff, certainly you've been involved in guideline criteria formation in these groups that are involved. I have not been, but curious to know where you see the field headed and can
well,
we
I love
this?
That you reviewed this paper and I love your comments. I think it is a mess. We've kind of deferred to MDD as the ground truth, but all of the studies that are cited as evidence are rife with confirmation biases that you can't avoid. And that goes for the pathology literature too. And I'm always curious. I mean, we know that when radiologists, good experienced chest radiologists, say that something is typical UIP, that the odds are overwhelming that it's UIP. I get the relabeling to connective tissue disease because that depends on other things. But when you also have diagnoses in that group of NSIP, that's like illegal, right? I mean, if you actually really do have UIP, you can't have NSIP. So it's a mess. And I think, what we lack is a ground truth against which to measure our efforts. So I love that you reviewed this. It's frustrating. I'm happy to say that I've left this field far worse off than it was before I ever participated in any of this work. So you're welcome.
Thank you for your hard work, Jeff. It is such a challenging field. I don't know that I've offered anything to the field of any use, but probably we all feel that way. It is a mess. It was a hard paper to even go through and review. All it does is highlight the problems without offering any breakthrough insights, I find. But
and why was there no interest in how pathology might inform? I guess they were just looking at the radiology, but I mean, what did Andy and Jody do? They must have done something. Some of these patients must have had biopsies.
I have no idea. In the paper, there's no mention of pathology or how any of that might have been incorporated into the MDD discussion. I even did a Control F search through the document to see if the word pathology was listed in the doc or biopsy was in the document anywhere. And there were no mentions of pathology or biopsy findings. So,
well, you know, it's interesting because as the number of biopsies go down, my anecdotal sense is, and I could be completely wrong, and I've talked to Chris Ryerson about this, is that biopsy is increasingly viewed as the problem rather than the solution. In Ryerson's kind of classic study on unclassifiable interstitial lung disease, the most common reason they couldn't classify it was because they didn't have a biopsy. In more recent studies, the most common reason for unclassifiable at MDD is discordance between radiology and the biopsy. So we have become actually the problem rather than the answer, which is weird, right? I mean, the world is upside down.
It is, and I work that our group did showing that, you know, there's probably a bias in the process away from classic cases. You know, the classic easy cases are disappearing. So we've enriched our pathology material for cases that are insoluble, that don't fit criteria for a specific pathology diagnosis, let alone a clinical pathologic diagnosis. That, you know, that probably is contributing to some of that issue, I think. But I don't know where it goes from here.
AI.
AI will save us all. Anybody else have any comments on this? Maybe they'll all disappear and it won't be our problem anymore. At least for the pathologists.
I think probably eventually it'll come back around. I think, you know, we're seeing the dip in the biopsies and, you know, the rise in other things. And I think over time, they're going to come back and realize that there are a percentage that would benefit from getting a biopsy diagnosis. I mean, there are certain things where the biopsy is incredibly helpful. I mean, ILD cases associated with aspiration, bring back to that first paper that you got, that they're not suspecting and we see food everywhere. So I don't think they'll disappear forever, but I'm wondering if there might be kind of a turnaround as the years go by.
I wonder the same thing. Yeah, thanks everybody for your comments. And for the sake of time, I do want to have a few minutes for this final paper, so I'll move along. But the last paper I chose for discussion today was a paper out of Japan published in European Respiratory Journal. The first author is Yudai Tamura with senior author Koichiro Tatsumi. This is on adult onset idiopathic peripheral pulmonary artery stenosis. It's a clinical paper, but I think it's important for us to be aware of. This paper was attended by an additional research letter that described the molecular findings in these patients in addition to an editorial. So I think this is a fairly high profile publication and something to pay attention to. Peripheral pulmonary artery stenosis is usually something that occurs in pediatric patients, but there have been case reports over the years, particularly coming out of East Asia, out of Japan and elsewhere, describing a peculiar pulmonary vasculopathy with segmental obstruction in the segmental or distal small pulmonary arteries. And this large Japanese group representing, I'm probably going to get the number wrong, I think it was 19 or 20 institutions across Japan, brought together all their experience with patients who have this adult onset idiopathic disorder with peripheral pulmonary artery abnormalities that is not chronic thromboembolic pulmonary hypertension, but some other type of animal, and decided to characterize them both with imaging and angiography. And so they ended up with 44 patients. The average age was 39. They're two-thirds of the patients were women. And then they did, they characterized their clinical findings, their investigated comorbid conditions, their right heart catheterization parameters. And then this is another article I just got to share the photos with from, because the pictures are worth a thousand words. So these are images comparing peripheral pulmonary, this adult onset idiopathic peripheral pulmonary artery stenosis with chronic thromboembolic pulmonary hypertension. So this first panel in the upper left, this is lung perfusion scintigraphy showing multiple wedge-shaped defects with normal lung ventilation scintigraphy, which was characteristic of this disorder. And then there's pulmonary angiography findings here with 3D reconstructions and these other images. And if you look really carefully, you can see there are segments of markedly stenotic arteries sort of in the mid to distal portions of the pulmonary arterial tree. I don't know if this projects well, but these localized obstructions. And they actually did optical coherence tomography where you do put the little ultrasound probe down into the pulmonary artery to characterize the pathology, at least from an ultrasound standpoint in these cases. And they had markedly thickened media in distinction to chronic thromboembolic pulmonary hypertension, which is shown in the final figure where you have the, of course, the webs within the lumen from old organized and recanalized thrombi or thromboemboli. This, see if I can find the diagram. This is the different segments that they examined. So pulmonary trunk, main pulmonary arteries, segmental pulmonary arteries, and peripheral pulmonary arteries. And they define these in the paper, but most of the abnormalities seen were at the segmental or peripheral levels, with very few abnormalities more proximally with these tight little stenoses. And then they examined the clinical outcomes with various therapeutics, pulmonary hypertensive meds, balloon angioplasty, et cetera. And I won't get into that, but the pathology here is really interesting. Unfortunately, there is no actual pathology in this paper, but the other findings are interesting. And the piece that I haven't shared yet, which is not in this paper, but in the companion research letter that's also published in the same issue of ERJ, about 80% of these patients have mutations in a single gene that is the RNF213 gene, whatever that is, but this is the gene that is also mutated in patients with Moyamoya disease. So that rare disease in East Asia, particularly in East Asian populations with cerebral artery stenoses and increased risk for stroke. Interestingly, in this cohort of 44 people, 20% of them had Moyamoya disease in addition to this peripheral pulmonary artery stenosis phenotype, at least as defined by angiography, even though there's no pathology illustrated in this. But it seems to be a clinically distinctive entity and with a defined molecular abnormality in East Asian populations, it might be something to keep our eyes open for if we end up with explants or even wedge biopsies from young to middle-aged patient of East Asian descent who has pulmonary hypertension. Look for those pulmonary artery stenoses in the mid to distal pulmonary arteries. So I don't know if anybody has even heard of this, let alone seen anything from a patient like this. But one of those things to put in your back pocket for weird chronic pulmonary vasculopathies that are not thromboembolic and not your typical plexogenic pulmonary hypertensive thing in young women, but this you know, this distinctive patient population. So any comments about this paper?
Well, first of all, thank you for bringing that to our attention. Maybe everyone else had heard about it, but I wasn't so aware of it. Now, if they would do a wedge biopsy, do you think we would actually find the abnormality? Because in your sketch, it seemed like very focal at a very distinct area in the tree. Now, what's the chance that a wedge biopsy will actually hit that? Is there something else we should look for?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, Anya. And I don't know if we would see it or not. And you know, sampling would be a big issue, but these seem to be localized. They're not diffuse vascular changes. They have segmental or focal lesions, much like fibromuscular dysplasia lesions, which in fact, about I think 10% of the patients in the series also had fibromuscular dysplasia of some other vascular bed in the body. So we may not see them. It might be something that can only really be defined angiographically, but I'd love to see what one really looks like if I were fortunate enough to get tissue that included the stenotic lesion in it. Maybe I'll never see it ever, but
it seems like if we ever did, it'd be an incidental finding in a lobectomy done for another reason, or maybe an autopsy. I don't know why. And they're generally younger women, right? So not a big cancer population. But yeah, I'd never heard of it. I don't know if I've seen it. I overlooked it. But we might not see it, as you say.
Yeah, we may never see these. Or maybe we might see them at autopsy if you ever get lucky enough. I'm surprised there was no pathology in this paper, because they do have clinical outcomes data in this, and it's not terrible, but it's not that great either. I think the 5-year survival was something like 80%, and the 10-year survival was like 60-something%. So, so some of these patients have died in the course of this, and there's no mention about whether or not autopsy had been done or anything been done to characterize the vascular changes, which would be really interesting, but somebody at some point will do that study. All right, well, that's all I've got today. If there are no other comments, we'll adjourn, but appreciate everybody joining us this morning for yet another nice journal club. So, and thanks, Dr. Moore, for helping out today.
Thank you. Thanks, Samantha and Brenda.
Thanks. Thank you. Nice selection of articles. Thanks. Have a good day.
Very nice.
I'll see you all next month.